Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Wednesday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. Ian Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later on this hour, we'll hear from an opponent of the proposed legalization of recreational marijuana in Arizona, and the city of Surprise is getting rid of recycling.
But we begin with news from the governor's office. Governor Doug Ducey split from President Trump yesterday on immigration. Not only did he express a desire for a more balanced approach to granting permanent legal status to immigrants, but he also questioned recent immigration raids, arguing that law enforcement should be prioritizing criminals. Trump's changes to the current green card policy would allow immigration officials to deny green cards and permanent legal status to immigrants if the government believes they will use assistance programs like food stamps or Medicaid in the future. Ducey spoke to reporters Tuesday.
So it can't just be about people at the top. It's got to also be about service workers and entry-level workers.
So does the governor's stance on these issues signal a greater rift within the GOP? Lisa James is a Republican consultant here in Arizona, and she joins us now to talk more about this. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning.
So that's the basic question to begin with. Were you surprised when you read what the governor had to say yesterday?
I'm actually not surprised in reading his words and listening to them. This governor has been very consistent that he is open for business, yet wants to secure our borders. And I think that what he said is right in line with his policy that he's been, you know, touting from when he first ran for governor.
Is there a broader feeling within the Republican Party that there are differences on how to approach immigration, especially as we see the Trump administration come out with policies supporting things like these immigration raids that are going on and the green card shift that happens this week?
You know, there's been a conversation about immigration in our country, but even within our party for the last, you know, since Reagan first granted asylum during his presidential term. And we've been having this conversation. And frankly, until the Congress acts and acts decisively, then we're going to continue to have this conversation. But I think that all in all, if you look at a state like Arizona, if you want to work here, we have jobs for you. And I think that's what the governor said, is we're open for business and we want you to have employees to hire.
Lisa, I'm going to go back to my poli-sci classes many years ago in college. We had the Main Street versus the Wall Street Republicans, and I don't want to simplify it too much, but a lot of people would call President Trump, though he's not a traditional Republican in many senses, as more the Main Street, Chamber of Commerce, more the Wall Street. Whether we're creating a bigger rift here than there is that a real rift, though, between the idea of populists sort of versus corporations and that sort of thing? Are we running into that, and is this maybe a display of that, where the governor's maybe trying to straddle both lines?
Well, I don't think that there is necessarily, I think that simplifies it, Wall Street versus Main Street. And I understand that that's a conversation we've had going on for a long time. But I think you can talk to people who may, you know, be in the restaurant business and have one restaurant, not multitudes of restaurants. But those people need employees. We need people in the hospitality services. And our farmers and ranchers are people looking for tradespeople. Everyone's not looking for someone with a four-year education anymore. We need people in at all level. And let's talk about it. This is America. This is what we're built on, is the opportunity to succeed. And that's what people are looking for. And that's what the governor believes Arizona has to offer, is an opportunity to succeed.
Where do you see this heading? I mean, if this is a real difference of how you think some Republicans are going to want to approach immigration versus what the Trump administration is doing here, do you see sort of a clash coming if they continue to push these lines?
I think that our governor, we're fortunate he has a good relationship with this White House, and I think that he will have no problem in expressing his concerns and doing so with an appreciation for what the president's done on the border. We need border security. We need to keep bad actors out. But we also need to, you know, we're the land of opportunity. We need to allow those who want to come here to work and to make a future for themselves and to benefit all of us by being part of this. But by being part of this melting pot of America, to do so.
Lisa, can the governor be a leader on this? And in some ways, does he really have to be a leader? Because that's been one criticism of the governor, that he's been effective, but maybe not someone who's out front. Is this one where he has to be a little bit more out front?
You know, I think that his words yesterday speak for himself. I mean, he definitely took a position, but I think it's one that most Arizonans and Americans agree with. We need to secure our borders, and we need people to drive our economy.
So this is the same sort of debate that you see play out. Steve mentioned the Chamber of Commerce, like when you see something like the president threatened to close the border and the governor says, you know, that's not a good idea. He changed his opinion a little bit on that afterward. But when it comes to these sort of business pocketbook issues, is this where you start to see a divide?
Well, I think you have two people, you know, our president is a businessman, our governor is a businessman, and I think that they will have a business-like conversation and be able to come to a reasonable conclusion on this. I really do.
All right. That's Lisa James, Republican consultant here in Arizona. Lisa, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The renewed push to legalize recreational marijuana use in Arizona has begun. The campaign is calling itself the Smart and Safe Arizona Initiative, and it'll need to collect more than 237,000 valid signatures to get on the 2020 ballot. Earlier this week on the show, the group's Stacey Pearson explained how this effort is different from the measure that failed in 2016.
It was a matter of talking to the opponents from 2016 and saying, hey, assume this is going to be successful. Let's make good policy. And they were more than happy to work with us.
There is strong opposition to the proposal. At this point, it's being led by the Center for Arizona Policy. And I'm joined by the organization's communications and media specialist, Cindy Dahlgren. Cindy, supporters are saying that Arizona voters' approval of legal recreational marijuana is inevitable. What's your reaction to that?
Well, they thought it was inevitable last time, too, in 2016. But when Arizona voters found out the consequences other states were enduring, they rejected it. And many of those consequences have not changed. This marijuana measure still puts our families at risk on the roads. It still makes it more accessible to teens. And they are still marketing it to children in high-potency candies and snacks. And banning certain shapes doesn't deter kids from eating it. I mean, candy gummies already come in various shapes.
Is there anything that you would feel like a recreational use of marijuana, to whatever extent, and I guess to whatever potency, would be acceptable at any point if adults were strictly allowed to use it?
The only winners are those in the big marijuana industry. Legalizing this high-potency marijuana is dangerous to teens. It leads to traffic deaths due to stoned drivers, and it is undisputably linked now to mental health issues in some people, among other things. There's just no safe way to legalize recreational marijuana.
Does it trouble you as well, as you mentioned, with the economic factor that there seems to be a push by this because a lot of people could make a lot of money from it?
That's not even the issue, except that the only ones who are going to be making money are those who people in the big marijuana industry, and many of them are from out of state. I think the thing that we want to be concerned about is the fact that, you know, we have learned from other states that regulations do not make marijuana safe. Where it is regulated and it is legal for adults only, more teens still use it. More people die on the roads due to marijuana use, and more people end up in the hospital. And now there is no disputing that there's growing evidence that this high-potency marijuana of today can lead to psychosis and other mental illness. Because we're not talking about a joint from the 70s that had like 2% THC in it. We're talking about marijuana that is now 20 to 25% THC when you're talking about smoking it, and when you're talking about eating it or vaping it and the other concentrates, it's 75 to 100% THC.
What about the argument some would make is that the more regulation there is for this case, then the more likely you are to be able to control how much THC there is?
All right. Well, according to this initiative, you really do not, because it does not leave the potency level to officials. It actually sets a minimum. So it sets a minimum that the state can consider. So the measure actually sets an arguably high level of THC per serving, and state officials can increase that level, but they cannot decrease it according to this measure. And I would add that minimum is a ruse in itself, because limited potency per serving doesn't mean anything when one cookie has 10 servings. Who eats a tenth of a cookie?
Cindy, let me ask you about the news release that the Center for Arizona Policy sent out. And just the headline was new packaging, same deception. One of the concerns for a lot of folks in the 2016 measure was impaired drivers. The current campaign says they have addressed that issue. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I read it, and it does absolutely nothing to address stoned drivers. The language in the initiative is, quote, driving impaired remains illegal. But there's no reliable roadside testing to measure impairment like there is for alcohol. They acknowledge that in Section 7 by leaving it to lawmakers to address when, quote, scientific research on the subject is conclusive, because right now it's not conclusive. And other states monitor THC levels in drivers, but none of them successfully.
How active a campaign is Senator for Arizona Policy expecting to put out? Are you expecting to be fairly aggressive? Is it going to be more of a responsive campaign or more out there to say this is a bad measure?
Well, we are working with several other people that we worked with when we were fighting Prop 205, and we will continue to work with them and fight this as vigorously as we have to and get the information out to the voters, because last time when the voters got the information and they realized what was in the initiative and what the other states were struggling with, they said no. So I think it's just a matter of getting the information out there.
There are some, and I would even say some that at least call themselves conservative, call themselves Republican certainly, have said that maybe the legislature and the governor should do something as a preemptive strike in some sense. Because once we have voter-approved measures with the Voter Protection Act, it would be difficult to change, if not impossible. What are your general thoughts on whether the legislature should launch a preemptive strike on this and consider doing some form of legalization?
No, I mean, there is not one successful example of a state legalizing recreational marijuana, whether it's through a ballot initiative or the legislature. And they're continually trying to address every concern that pops up. And when more people die on the roads and more people are in the hospital, and then they're banning the shapes of gummies, and they're trying to make all these changes because there's just no successful standard, and there is no safe way to legalize it. Again, the only winners are those who are in the big marijuana industry. You know, it's just like the tobacco industry, right? The tobacco companies told us that their product was safe and it was only for adults. And look where that got us. Tobacco kills, and they were marketing it to kids. And we see the same thing here.
Cindy Dahlgren of the Center for Arizona Policy. Cindy, thank you.
Thank you.
With early voting underway for the August 27th election that will decide whether to cancel future light rail extensions in Phoenix, we've been taking a closer look this week at arguments both for and against the transportation system. And for that, we're joined now by KJZZ's Christina Estes. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Lauren.
Okay, so yesterday you broke down funding sources, ridership figures, and operating costs for us. And today you want to dive into one figure in particular here. So what's that?
It's $11 billion. That's the amount light rail supporters use as a measure of success. In its economic development brochure, Valley Metro says $11 billion in public and private investment has been made along the line since 2005. And it's important to note that light rail did not open until December 2008.
So why are projects included 3 years before the line opened?
Well, because certain people knew it was coming. For example, developers were talking about light rail before it opened because they knew the city was using eminent domain to buy private property, and contractors started working pretty quickly after the funding agreement was signed in 2005.
Okay, so you got a hold of Valley Metro's database of development projects that it attributes to light rail. What'd you find?
The database includes 344 projects Valley Metro says are located within a half a mile of a light rail line. The projects are either currently under construction or completed going back to 2005, with the exception of one project. It dates back to 2002. That was 3 years before construction started.
What's that one?
It's the first phase of Hayden Ferry Lakeside in Tempe. Today, it's this big mixed-use development along Tempe Town Lake, but its first building opened in 2002 and accounts for more than $21 million in Valley Metro's database. There are also several projects that someone could argue would have happened anyway without light rail.
Like what?
In 2005 and 2006 in Tempe, two buildings went up as part of ASU's Biodesign Institute. Those buildings add up to $150 million in Valley Metro's database. There's also the Phoenix Art Museum's expansion completed in 2006. That appears in the database as an $18 million redevelopment project.
Okay, so what's the biggest item in this database?
The $600 million expansion of the Phoenix Convention Center. It started in the early 2000s and wrapped up just in time for light rail's opening in 2008. Supporters say light rail was a critical part of downtown's transformation, and it'll be good for other areas too. Of course, not everyone buys that.
Right. We've heard concerns from people in South Phoenix, especially about construction hurting small businesses there.
And there's no doubt some businesses will not survive. We have seen that happen. I can tell you the city and Valley Metro have set aside additional money to support South Phoenix businesses during construction through marketing and advertising services and offering low interest loans.
What about concerns the light rail will bring more crime to neighborhoods? We hear that a lot as well.
Yep, that's also something that we've heard in areas that have light rail. For example, along 19th Avenue, mm-hmm. residents have complained a lot about inappropriate and illegal behavior on the trains and platforms. About 2 years ago, we reported on a large increase in calls to police along 19th Avenue. Trespassing, shoplifting, thefts were among the most common calls.
Okay, and refresh our memory. How did Phoenix Police and Valley Metro respond to all of that?
Well, police increased patrols, and then Valley Metro added more private security officers. And I noticed those security officers when I rode light rail just last week.
What was it like?
It was like riding public transportation. It's mass transit, so it's open to everyone. I saw great diversity. And not just race and ethnicity, but also people who use wheelchairs and people who carried their bicycles on.
What route did you take?
I got on at 19th Avenue and Dunlap, rode through downtown to 38th Street and Washington.
So the train picked up and dropped off a lot of people along the way, I'm sure.
Yeah. And most people were quiet and sort of in their own world. But there was also the guy talking really loudly on his phone, another guy who sat next to me with really strong cologne. Again, it's public transit, so you have variety.
Okay, so let's move on to your conversation with a longtime Phoenix resident who lives near the 19th Avenue light rail line. Did she tell you how she's planning to vote?
When we talked late last week, she was still torn. I didn't record the conversation, and I'm not using her name because she's been active in the community for a really long time. She works with the city on neighborhood projects and doesn't want to risk hurting those relationships.
Got it. So why is she torn about the future of this light rail extension?
In her view, light rail has not been a positive experience for her neighborhood. So in one sense, she wants to vote for Prop 105, which would end future projects. On the other hand, she says she doesn't want her area to be the end of the line because she worries it'll create a dead-end environment.
But 19th Avenue has seen improvements since the 3 mile extension opened 3 years ago, right?
It has. Some well-known restaurant chains have opened, and some of the established neighborhoods around 15th Avenue and 21st Avenue are seeing more market rate housing being built. But that's not enough to convince a resident I talked to last night after he filled out his ballot.
Okay, how did he vote?
He voted for Prop 105.
And why? Why? What was his reasoning?
Well, for one, he says it's inconvenient for most people to use. Over the weekend, he said he was going to take it from 19th Ave in Phoenix to Washington Street and Mill Avenue in Tempe. Going one way, he said the train would have stopped 21 times and taken 52 minutes, so he just ended up driving. He also thinks construction takes too long and it's too disruptive. He thinks express buses are a cheaper, faster alternative.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard light rail opponents argue that changing technology could mean fewer people use light rail in the future. What does Valley Metro say about that?
A spokesperson told me in the future, Valley Metro will continue to advance a network of transportation options, including rideshare and autonomous vehicles, to support quick growth and limited real estate. She said high-capacity transit is and will be the most effective way to move large numbers of people in finite spaces.
All right. And that's KJZZ's Christina Estes filling us in on all of the debate around Prop 105 and the future of the light rail here. Christina, thank you.
You're welcome.
The city of Surprise will no longer be picking up recyclables. Instead, what goes in the blue bins will go, along with the trash, to the landfill. The city's public works director says it was a difficult decision, but one officials had been thinking about for a while. He says the city has been working with the local recycling center without a contract since their last deal expired more than 18 months ago and hasn't been able to get a new agreement with that entity or any other. Our co-host Mark Brody spoke with Mike Gent, Surprise's public works director, more about it.
In talking to my counterparts around the valley, I believe that the actual cost that they were offering would have made us the highest cost recycling hauler in the valley. But by itself, that wasn't the only reason or even the main reason why we made the decision that we announced. The main reason was the current system just isn't working. So they announced that the city of Surprise, that more than 40% of what the city of Surprise has brought to them as recyclables in the last year, they have brought to the landfill directly. We know that through their system, even more material is going to the landfill as it gets sorted out because their equipment doesn't have all of the ability to collect all the recyclable material, so some of it's going to end up at the landfill. And so we've looked for other solutions. We've talked with other municipalities. There are some things in the works that hopefully will allow us to come back online with processing our recycling responsibly and sustainably going forward, but they're not available today.
So it sounds like the issue wasn't so much that surprise residents were putting things in their recycling bins that couldn't be recycled. It was more on the contractor's end that they weren't able to accept some of the things that the city had said were recyclable. Is that right?
Well, let's be clear. We certainly have contamination that our residents are responsible for. That is part of the problem. But absolutely, a large part of that problem is the system just simply isn't sophisticated enough to sort the material appropriately, and there's not enough incentive to make it more appropriate because the demand for recycled material is at an all-time low. And so it's a combination between contamination from our residents, a lack of desire to sort out the recyclables because there's no demand for it, and then, of course, that lack of demand overall. We really need an innovation in the recycling industry that will be able to capture recyclables, and that change is going to happen when there's companies out there that want to buy recycled material. But right now, you name the commodity, the demand is horribly low.
Well, it's interesting. I was going to ask you if you thought this was in any way related to, for example, China saying it was no longer going to accept American recyclables. It sounds like, to some extent, that is part of what's going on here.
Absolutely. So, you can't blame China for it. They just no longer had a market for the recyclables. And so, of course, they said no. And the other countries that have been shifted to since then have also got to the place where they're saying, no, we don't want your trash.
You mentioned that the city might have some things in the works looking ahead.
Yes.
I'm wondering
yeah.
what some of those options might look like to restart the city's recycling program.
Sure. Well, so there's some traditional options available, so finding another partner that offers us a reasonable contract similar to what we've had in the past, or with the new reality of the market, but just reasonably priced and reasonably termed that allows our residents to get the value they deserve, could allow us to turn right back on the recyclables. So with our current change in the program, we're asking residents to not change their behavior, to continue to use the blue bin for recyclables, the black bin for their trash. And one of the advantages of this approach is that we could immediately turn back on recyclables and begin to bring them to another facility if we found a partner that worked that way. So that's one option. Another option is getting together with other cities and finding a regional public option that would allow us to move forward without having to worry about profits for shareholders and just worrying about sustainability for the environment. And then the third option might be the best option, and that is attracting innovation. We hope that a city that wants to recycle, that has residents that are sorting recyclables but doesn't have a place to bring them, attracts innovation and ideas from places that are looking for a home for it. And maybe that will be the answer for this broken recycling system that we have currently, and it allows our residents to responsibly recycle for the first time in quite a while.
How concerned are you that having residents know that even if they put stuff in the blue recycling bins, it's still going to the landfill, people will stop doing that, even though you want them to continue doing it as if it was going to the landfill? I would imagine that there's got to be some amount of concern that people are just going to say, well, why should I bother sorting stuff if it's all going to the same place anyway?
Yeah, we'd like the consumer behavior to be as good as possible for when we flip that switch back on for recycling. However, if a resident wants to put their recycling in their trash to bag and tie it and put it in their black bin, they're welcome to do that. And certainly we're not going to be looking for that and having any problems with that. But most residents, or many of our residents at least, require the extra space that putting those big bulky items like cardboard and laundry detergent bottles and milk bottles and those kind of things in the blue bin gives them that extra space they need. So many, if not most of our residents require the space of two different bins. So I'm guessing even if they wanted to, many will continue just because of that need for that additional space.
Are you aware of other cities, either in the Valley or in Arizona or elsewhere around the country, that have had to do what you're doing here?
Yeah, absolutely. There's quite a list around the country. We, as far as I know, are the first in the Valley to do this. However, there's at least 10 other communities around the state of Arizona that have done it. These pressures are being felt everywhere. And so this conversation has happened in larger cities than ours and are still happening in larger cities than ours. While I hope that we all can find viable, responsible recycling solutions long term, I would not be surprised if in the near future you see other cities making this similar choice for temporary suspension because of the state of recycling that's out there.
All right. That's Mike Gent. He's Public Works Director for the City of Surprise. Mike, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day.
Today, we continue our special series, Tracing the Migrant Journey, in which correspondents from the Fronteras Desk explore the path crossed by migrants coming from Central America. Jorge Valencia was with us from Honduras starting this week. And today, KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau Chief Rodrigo Cervantes takes us to an area with historic and commercial ties that's been quickly transforming due to recent migration policies, the Guatemala-Mexico border. Rodrigo, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So you've been reporting over the past few days in an area that gained a lot of notoriety after the so-called migrant caravans crossed it. So what can you tell us specifically about this area?
Well, there's this town called Ciudad Hidalgo on the Mexican side and Tecunumán in the Guatemalan side. These are two towns divided by the Siuchiate River, but strongly linked by their routes and also by trade. Think about this as a smaller and less wealthy version of the two Nogales. People here cross from one side to the other by foot, by car. They use the bridges here, but they also use rafts to cross the river. And all of this makes it an ideal crossing point for the recent large migrant caravans that we've seen in the past couple of years. This until Mexico placed temporary fences to contain and regulate one of the caravans recently. And you probably remember this story, Steve, in which the caravan actually knocked them down. Let's remember that Mexico allows transitory migrants and refugees into the country, but now requires more paperwork. And that's what the Mexican government was trying to do, try to organize the caravan, but the caravan just couldn't wait.
You spent some time in Guatemala, and that's the only nation so far that has accepted and it's signed an immigration agreement with the U.S. to become what we're calling a safe third country. Now, what does that mean? Define that for us. And what have you heard from the population there as far as their reaction to it?
The agreement arriving to Central America to Guatemala need to apply for asylum in the U.S. They don't have to go to the United States to do so. So many Guatemalans opposed to it. They consider it a violation of Guatemala's sovereignty, and it hasn't been fully implemented yet. Another migration-related factor that it's impacting the area comes from the Mexican side of the border. This is the recently formed National Guard, which is patrolling the area. And also Mexico is having stricter migratory policies to revise documentation. I spoke to Mario Morales. He coordinates a nonprofit helping transitory migrants, and this is what he said.
El migrante está usando ahora otras vías alternas, más peligrosas y con más violaciones a derechos humanos por la situación en que los detienen.
So Morales says that migrants are still crossing Mexico, but through areas that are more dangerous. And he thinks that they're exposed to more crime and to human rights violations now.
And Rodrigo, this is an especially interesting time with Guatemala facing some big political changes. It marked presidential elections last Sunday, and this is really important when it comes to a lot of these policies. Who won the elections, and what's his take on immigration?
Well, it was a former doctor and jail director named Alejandro Giammattei. He won the election, and in fact, this was his fourth attempt. He is a politician inclined to the right. He opposes, for instance, gay marriage and abortion. And speaking about immigration, in recent interviews, he has said that he's against the Safe Third Country Agreement. But he also thinks of developing what he calls a wall of trade and prosperity between Mexico and Guatemala, meaning that he wants to develop the area and to try to stop migrants for up north and just stay in this border zone and develop it. The community in Tecunumán, what I heard is that there is a strong division on migration issues. Some feel empathy for the undocumented migrants arriving there, but others don't.
And Rodrigo, let me close with this. Immigration policies really affect the dynamics between the border towns that are so intertwined. We've, of course, seen it here in the Arizona-Sonoran region before. But what about the area you visited between Mexico and Guatemala? What stands out there?
Well, Steve, the biggest impact that stricter immigration controls have brought to the area, according to all the people I talked to, is mainly aid and ergo, I would say, on the local economy. Guatemalans go to the Mexican side to buy plenty of goods, which are way cheaper in Mexico, but that has decreased significantly. And the chain effect hits the renters of the rafts, for instance, as they have less customers, or people like Esther Lopez, who sells street food on the Mexican side of the river, and is what she told me.
Ha estado bien hasta que llegaron todos los de migración, los demás, el ejército y la marina. Ha bajado bastante la venta.
So Ms. Lopez says that the sales dramatically dropped after the army, the National Guard, and the immigration officials arrived on the Mexican side. And the issue, as I heard, is also concerning the local governments.
Learn more from our Tracing the Migrant Journey series at kjzz.org and follow our correspondent steps through this special coverage on Twitter using the hashtag Migrant Journey. And that is KJZZ Rodrigo Cervantes joining us from the Guatemala-Mexico border. Rodrigo, thanks very much. Take care.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the show here on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger, along with Steve Goldstein. Stay tuned at 11 o'clock for The Takeaway. And Steve, believe it or not, it is, in fact, monsoon season, even though we haven't seen a lot of rain.
Yeah, it seemed a bit anticlimactic, but that cannot be said, Lauren, of the monsoon stories so far this season.
Thank you very much, and I agree. This year, we're focusing on how we experience the season through our five senses, how they look, feel, sound, smell, and even taste. We have a few more entries coming in this. Stay tuned on Fridays.
And if you want to join in, there are a lot of ways to participate. You can go to monsoon.kjzz.org and submit your best monsoon photo, or you can call 480-774-8299 to share your story.
Yes, please do, because we love to air your stories on air during this series. It's been a lot of fun to do that. So join in.
Many students are back in the classroom as a new school year kicks off, and their teachers have likely been busy ahead of their return. For many teachers, that might mean they've spent their own money on a variety of classroom items that their schools and districts did not or would not provide. Hundreds of teachers have shared their tabs on social media, some reporting hundreds, even thousands of dollars spent so far this year. Rebecca Gorelli is a sixth grade science teacher in Phoenix and one of the leaders behind last year's Red for Ed movement, and she joins us now to talk about the sometimes pricey preparations. Rebecca, good morning. Are you seeing any noticeable difference in the classroom that indicates that actually more money has been committed there?
Absolutely not. The only actual dollars we've seen have come in small increases in paychecks. Not one teacher I've spoken to or heard on Facebook through, we've been doing a little bit of surveying on our Facebook pages and listening to comments from people, is that the money is not trickling down to the classroom, the actual needs of the classroom for supplies, infrastructure. We haven't seen that yet. But the only monies we have seen are directly related to increases, very small increases in salary.
What does that say to you then about what's going on?
It says that we're not prioritizing the actual needs of the classroom. We're not prioritizing the needs of the teachers or the students. Class size is still enormously large. I put a Facebook post asking people, what's your class size this year? Where are you standing as we speak at the beginning of the year? And we're looking at 30 plus in many classes, even down to kindergarten, which is very disheartening because we need additional funding to decrease the size and really increase student achievement. And it's just disheartening.
Teachers have already had to spend out of their own pockets when it comes to their classrooms to try to help their students, whether it's to create a more comfortable learning environment, that sort of thing. What are teachers having to prioritize in terms of spending like that?
So we actually, you know, surveyed people a little bit ago asking, you know, how much did you spend in your classroom and what was that spending actually spent on, what materials? And so we had people anywhere from basic necessities of notebooks and pencils and glue to I need furniture, I don't have any shelving. And the shelving I do have is actually, you know, falling apart and crumbling. So I'm just going to go and purchase something or go to Goodwill on my own accord. I just think there's a spectrum of where people are spending their dollars, anywhere from $50 all the way up to over $1,000. And it's a combination of basic necessities just to engage students in the learning process through all the way to, you know, decorating their classroom to make a more, you know, welcoming and inviting space for their students.
As we said, you are an educator in Phoenix, and at least your specialty, I will say, is science. And I wanted to ask you just one specific question about that, because when we're looking at science standards changing, and I know that in the past you've talked about having to use expired chemicals and whatnot for science labs, is there a bigger concern that that disparity is going to get even greater as the standards may have expectations that are going to cause certain things to fall even further behind because you don't have the material you need?
I'm really glad you asked that question. We have both new science and social studies standards. And so for educators to implement those instructional shifts and be successful in doing so, yes, that's going to require new resources. Yes, that may require new materials. We definitely can pull from our old resources, but I definitely think there's a correlation between having new standards and then not directly purchasing new curriculum, which obviously is, you know, we're a local control state. The ability to purchase materials comes through districts. But in general, yes, I would say that new science standards, new social studies standards are going to mean that educators are going to be spending more out of their pockets because they want to implement those standards in the appropriate, best way for their students.
As we look ahead to 2020, the legislative session, certainly the Red for Ed movement has made a huge impact here in Arizona. And I wonder, going forward, how much do you expect there to have to be an effort? It doesn't have to necessarily be more candidates, though that may be the case, who have education backgrounds, but even just having to keep a closer eye on what the legislature is doing, what the governor is doing. How active do you expect the movement to be?
I anticipate the movement to be incredibly active. I think people have now had their eyes open to, you know, the legislative process, how it works, where funding comes from. I think we've done a really great job educating our members about the legislative process and really trying to plug people into the process so they understand it and then can figure out the best way that they want to spend their time. Where do they want to be active? Do they want to be active in a legislative district? Do they want to spend time going to their local governing, you know, school boards, that kind of thing? So I think, you know, it's going to vary. I think some districts are going to be heavily going to governing board meetings. I think other districts might want to pour their time into legislative districts that can be flipped. I mean, I think it's all going to depend on where you are and what, you know, what your commitment is to the movement. But I'm going to say overall, I think we're very dedicated to continuing this work moving forward.
Is it possible to maintain that kind of momentum?
You know, in any movement, I think we have, you know, sort of a roller coaster pattern where we have, you know, strength in numbers and coming out in full force to, you know, slowing down and taking a step back. And so I think we're going to see movement in different ways. I think, you know, different issues will motivate and mobilize different groups. And over time, I'd say that we're moving forward no matter what. But the amount of energy is definitely going to vary depending on the issues and the locals.
All right. That is Rebecca Gorelli. She is a Phoenix-based educator. Rebecca, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
As the new school year gets underway, the issue of education funding is still front and center here in Arizona, as you just heard. The teacher shortage in our state persists, and many educators still say they aren't seeing enough money go toward education from the state legislature. In the last year, we've seen teacher walkouts and protests here and around the country. As the debate over teacher pay and the value of public education came to a head. So what has all of this done to an organization like Teach for America, whose mission is all about recruiting new teachers? For more on that, I sat down with Steve Erickson, Vice President for External Affairs for Teach for America, who said it's not hurting their recruiting efforts. In fact, it might be helping them.
If you look at the numbers, it hasn't. So, you know, our recruiters might say something different. They might say, you know, the conversations are a little bit more nuanced or a little bit more challenging in some ways when we're talking to folks. But this year, actually, we had 56,000, just over 56,000 people apply to Teach for America nationally. The largest number of applications we've ever received in a single year is 58,000. So I think this was the second highest number of applications we've ever had. So we haven't seen it actually hurt our numbers. But in terms of the conversation, so we're sitting down with folks one-on-one and saying, this is the issue of our generation, of our lifetime. We need to solve the education crisis that exists, and we want to bring you into that. We want you to be a part of that. We want to ensure that children growing up in low-income communities have just as much of an opportunity to be successful as children growing up in more affluent communities, and we want you to be a part of this. And I think that message doesn't change whether there are teacher strikes or not.
How are Teach for America teachers paid? Are they paid the same as every other teacher in that district? And that's, you know, been a central issue in a lot of this.
They are. So when we bring a core member, that's what we call our teachers in the initial two-year commitment to Teach for America, when they join our program, they are placed in a school district that Teach for America partners with. So they're first and foremost full-time employees of that school district or the charter school that they're placed in. They are on the same pay scale as any other starting teacher.
And that's not affecting this? That's not making it more difficult to convince people that, you know, this is a hard job that's not going to pay a lot?
I think if anything, some of the recent conversation around that might be putting some wind to our backs because people are realizing, wow, this is a serious issue. We need to come together and come up with some real solutions for this. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have, because I mentioned earlier, we believe that the teacher plays such a critical role in the education system. We will always advocate for and believe in, you know, better resources, including increased pay for teachers. So yeah, I think it's part of the ongoing challenge, but it's not a new one necessarily for us.
So it's an initial two-year commitment. What percentage of teachers from Teach for America stay in the profession after that?
Yeah, so when we bring teachers into the program, you know, it changes year to year, but about 80 to 90%, depending on the year, are coming from a background other than a formal education training or like a major in education. And then we see after that two-year commitment, about two-thirds stay in teaching beyond that. So, and that's a national statistic. Locally, it's even a little higher than that. We see around 70% or more end up staying in teaching beyond those 2 years. Mm-hmm. If you look across our alumni base, so folks who have successfully completed the Teach for America program, that initial two-year commitment you mentioned, folks who live in Arizona, about 80%, a little bit more, are working full-time in education. Hmm. So a large portion of those teachers are in the classroom as full-time teachers, but we also have folks who are founding schools, starting schools in low-income communities, leading as principals, assistant principals, instructional coaches. We even have folks who've moved into district leadership and personnel positions across the education system. An example is the Phoenix Union High School District, which is the largest high school district in the state. That district, the superintendent is a Teach for America alum. And then we also have some folks who move into other fields outside of education, which we also find very important. We want elected officials, policymakers, lawyers, doctors, businesswomen and businessmen who are grounded in the experience of being a classroom teacher, understand the challenges that our students face growing up in poverty, but also have a deep, unwavering belief in those students and their ability to be successful when we give them the opportunity. We want decision makers and influencers in all of those sectors to be grounded in that type of belief and experience.
But this is also a little bit of a challenging time for Teach for America. There was a bill in California that would essentially make it impossible for you to operate there. And proponents of that bill argue that essentially Teach for America ends up actually kind of fueling the academic disparities that it's trying to combat. Do you understand that concern?
I can't speak to the specific California bill. But yeah, you know, those arguments do come up time to time. You know, one thing I'd say is every person, I've been involved with Teach for America for about 15 years now. I started as a teacher in the program myself. And I'd say of the hundreds of people that I've met who've been a part of this organization, you know, every one of them is committed to seeing students be successful. Mm-hmm. That is how we design our programming. It's how we look for candidates to join our work. It's all through this lens of what are we doing to improve opportunities for students. It's even how we measure our own success. So when we look at student outcomes, when we look at learning outcomes, it's about are our students in a better place from a learning standpoint than they were when, you know, we stepped into the classroom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say if you look at outcomes, those concerns, I don't think, stand up.
All right. Steve Erickson is Vice President for External Affairs for Teach for America. Steve, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Most of us try to avoid getting audited by the IRS when we file our taxes every year, but this year, Luke Douglas is hoping to attract tax officials' attention. Douglas is the executive director of the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix, and he is using himself as a test case for a federal tax exemption for clergy. He's hoping to prove that he should qualify for the same exemption in his role with the secular humanist organization. It's a case the Freedom From Religion Foundation decided not to pursue to the Supreme Court. And I sat down with Douglas recently to talk more about it.
So the parsonage exemption in the U.S. tax code says that a pastor can receive a housing allowance from the church that employs them and not report that in their personal income taxes in the way that all of us take a salary and have to pay taxes on the full amount. It's one exception to the way in which all nonprofits are sometimes treated the same as houses of worship, but in this case, houses of worship get a special tax benefit.
So I want to back up and talk about what exactly it is that you do and what the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix is. Do you consider yourself clergy?
I don't like to use that word, but as the executive director, that's an administrative job. I organize a community of non-believers who engage in everything from bringing in educational speakers to activism to community service of a variety of types. And the clergy aspect of that is a certification that the American Humanist Association has called a celebrant, which means I'm legal to perform weddings and funerals and give invocations at legislative gatherings and all of the things that traditional clergy are able to do.
Right. And the Humanist Society is something that's been around for a long time. Can you give us a little history?
Yeah, actually, starting in the early 70s, the humanists of Greater Phoenix would meet in restaurants and coffee shops. And then in 2005, they incorporated as their own nonprofit. They got a building earlier this decade. And earlier this year, took the leap of faith of hiring a full-time executive director to try and take their organization to the next level.
And give us a sense of what it is that you believe. This is a nonprofit organization, obviously. Is it a non-religion? Is it an anti-religion?
Well, our focus is always on building a positive alternative more than on anything that we don't believe. So the idea is a progressive philosophy of life in which critical thinkers will try to live better lives through open discussion, through following the evidence, and through coming together to form a community of people who are trying to do likewise.
Mm-hmm. How large is the organization here?
It's around 300 members and a lot more people who come and go and participate at different levels.
So let's talk about this test case idea, right? So critics say that this exemption is like a subsidy for clergy, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you're not challenging its existence. You're challenging the way it's applied.
Our contention is that it should apply the same to religious and secular nonprofits. So from a tax policy standpoint, whether you'd rather have it apply to everybody or have it apply to nobody, that's for Congress and the president to decide. But as far as the separation of church and state goes, it should be the same across the board.
And what would that look like for you? I mean, how big of a difference would this make in your work?
It would make a pretty small difference in my, you know, my personal finances, because, again, it's to the clergy specifically, not to the organization. And, of course, with the risk that if we lose the case, I'd have to pay that back later. Mm-hmm. But the main issue that I'm interested in is being a test that will allow different secular organizations around the country to look at this and say, oh, now we can start professionalizing. We can start having people who are either full-time or part-time to organize our communities. And if we provide a housing allowance, that makes it more financially achievable for organizations to go from volunteer run to professionally run.
I wonder how you came to the decision to do this. I mean, was there a conversation in which you said, I don't know if it's really worth it, or do I want to be the person at the center of this?
Well, I think for me, it comes down to looking at the biggest opportunity to make an impact. And so when I see a court case that has stalled at a certain point and there's an opportunity to pick it up and take it to the next level and potentially even take it to the Supreme Court and make a real difference, that's a no-brainer. I'm not excited about getting the IRS more involved in my life, but that is the cost of doing business for making a difference.
Is it a guarantee that they are going to challenge you on this?
There's no guarantee that there will be a court case, but I think even inaction would effectively set the precedent that it's worth trying for other organizations, that it won't be as big of a risk for the second person that tries it as it would be for the first.
Do you feel like you are often overlooked as a, like you say, non-believer?
I would say that non-believers have a disadvantage going in terms of the organization level. And I think the last time you mentioned HSGP on the air was in reference to some new polling data about religious unaffiliated surpassing both evangelicals and Catholics in the United States. Mm-hmm. You would never think that in terms of the religious dialogue in public policy. And all of that comes down to organization. And so humanism seeks to take some of these religious nuns, many of whom come out of traditional faith.
Nuns, N-O-N-E-S.
Yes. These religiously unaffiliated people and say, all right, you don't have anything filling the void left by a religion that you may have left. Well, let's form these communities and give ourselves a united voice to go to the next level of doing good in the world.
It's interesting, right? Because religions are these organized bodies, and that's often what non-believers or people who don't want to be involved in religion criticize religion for. Like, I don't want to be part of a broader institution that tells me what to believe. Do you think that that's what you're trying to do as an organization of non-believers?
I definitely hear that every day. But I think the real difference is how we organize and what we do when we organize. Humanism is about forming an umbrella under which people can gather with their different ideas and a diversity of viewpoints and discuss them critically without a creed from the top down telling us what to believe.
Luke Douglas is the executive director of the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix. Luke, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.